Welcome to the Bruce Poinsett Show. This is the world's most dangerous infomercial, and I'm your host, Bruce Poinsett. And along with my producer, Ado, in the background, we give you this news, interviews, and commentary experience bi-weekly. Right now, we're live on Twitch at twitch.tv/thenumbersfm. That's numbers with a Z. Make sure to follow so you catch it every other Thursday. And you can also catch the full show every second and fourth Wednesday at 7 p.m. on The Numbers FM, as well as clips on youtube.com/BrucePoinsett and exclusive bonus content on patreon.com/BrucePoinsett. Right now, we've got a full review and conversation about The Batman featuring me, Ado, and DJ Ambush, where we dig into, you know, all the problems the Waynes have caused to destroy Gotham. So you got to check that out. But like I said, we begin each new show with news stories you might have missed, but should definitely be on your radar. So now, without further ado, the news. Our first story comes from K2, and it's from Sunday, and it's a Portland Street Response expands citywide on Monday. According to the article, Portland Street Response started in February 2021 as a pilot program in the Lentz neighborhood. It is part of a Portland Fire and Rescue's Community Health Division and sends an unarmed response to non-life-threatening behavioral and mental health crisis calls. Portland Street Response now has a full staff of 20 members and covers 145 square miles from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. 7 days a week. During Monday's meeting, officials said the goal was to increase staffing from 20 to 58 members. And further in the article, they write, in the pilot period of the program in the Lentz neighborhood, the police call load was down nearly 5%. That would equate to more than 8,500 calls that officers would not have to respond to if PSR was operating citywide around the clock. And lastly, from the article, this is the first time in 150 years that Portland has added a new emergency branch to the city. What this should tell you, though, is for those of us who advocate for defunding the police, this is part of what that looks like in practice. It's not just this idea of, you know, letting anarchy take reign. It's actually replacing armed officers with people more equipped to respond to situations, especially, you know, non-violent, non-emergency situations. So hopefully you can get, one, a better impact, something that better serves people and also keeps the community safer. So we'll stay tuned for how Portland Street Response continues to grow. Our next story comes from Willamette Week. This is by Sophie Peel. It's titled, Portland City Hall Sweeps 50 Camps Along Highways and Streets Deemed Most Dangerous. So according to Peel, since February 5th, when Mayor Ted Wheeler enacted an emergency ban on camping along highways and the city's most dangerous streets, city workers have swept 50 homeless camps. The mayor's office provided a list of swept locations to Willamette Week on March 29th. Many of those camps were along Interstate 5, 205, and 405, including on and off ramps, and most were located in North and Northeast Portland. A number of camps along Southeast Powell Boulevard were also swept. The mayor's office did not immediately say whether it had data on which camps, if any, had reestablished themselves since the removal. And further in the article, Peel writes, Wheeler says the highway camping ban is intended to reduce the number of unhoused people hit by cars. He issued the emergency ban February 5th, shortly after findings by the Portland Bureau of Transportation showed 70% of pedestrians killed last year were homeless, a total of 19 people. So this is an important story to look at because obviously we're in the midst of a houseless crisis in Portland, but what are the solutions to actually deal with that? One of the more popular solutions posed by especially business associations has been to sweep camps, to remove camps. And I think that's why a key part of this article talks about how there isn't much data as far as where any camps have been reestablished. And as we look at this, we can't just look at solutions through the eyes of people, you know, who frankly, you know, are very indifferent to the actual well-being of our houseless community. And it's going to take solutions that one, prioritize them and also bring their perspectives into play. And even in a situation like this, where it's being framed as, you know, protecting people from safety, you have to ask yourself, what safety are we protecting people from if we're literally taking their homes away and not doing anything after that? Some food for thought. Next story also comes from Willamette Week. This is by Nigel Jacquees and Rachel Monahan. And this is, tenant advocates seek a new Multnomah County capital gains tax to pay for eviction fighting lawyers. The PBA pushes back. The PBA, for those who don't know, is the Portland Business Alliance. So according to the authors, the Eviction Representation for All initiative, filed with Multnomah County on March 3rd by tenants' rights and social justice nonprofits, is aimed at the November ballot. The measure proposes to levy a tax of 0.75% on capital gains, which generally speaking are profits investors earn on sale of assets such as stocks, bonds, or real estate to fund a new program, which would contract with five lawyers to provide free legal representation for tenants facing eviction. Proponents have hoped to raise $12 million to $15 million a year. Quote, we see this protection as crucial to keeping people housed, says Donovan Scribes, a spokesperson for the Community Alliance of Tenants, which supports the proposed tax. Tenants are under the impression that by the time they achieve a court summons, an eviction is inevitable, even when this is not the case, end quote. Further on the article, on March 28th, the Portland Business Alliance filed a challenge to the ballot title and an explanatory statement for the proposed measure. PBA lobbyist John Isaacs says the tax is a bad idea that would make a tough economic situation worse. The Portland region is already facing an affordability crisis driven primarily by the cost of housing and taxes, Isaac says. In 2020, voters passed a bevy of new taxes, a Portland Public Schools bond, a new Multnomah County tax, or new Multnomah County library tax, a Portland Parks and Recreation levy, a Metro Homeless Service measure, and a County Preschool for All measure. All that left high-income county residents paying one of the highest combined marginal tax rates in the country. And the ballot challenge by the PBA indicates that top executives at local companies may have lost their appetite for making concessions to progressives. Further in the article, the brewing flap comes on the heels of an unrelated group, People for Portland, filing a different ballot measure March 25th. That measure would redirect money from the 2020 Metro Homeless Services Tax, prescribing that 75% of the $250 million a year it raises in three counties be spent on homeless shelters, and requiring local governments to enforce anti-camping laws to get their cash. If it sounds familiar, we've talked about this earlier in a former news segment, and that proposal would also come with armed guards. So, again, we're talking about measures of dealing with not just houselessness, but also the rent crisis in this that's been happening since the pandemic, and tenants' rights, because we are constantly, seemingly every month, on the verge of an eviction disaster, really. And what you've seen in this article is interesting because the new tax measure would, again, target the wealthy. In my humble opinion, those who actually have the money to support that. But what you're seeing is also this argument that it's not fair because it'd be one of the highest marginal tax rates in the country. Now, I'll be honest with you, doesn't exactly move the needle to me because I still go around Portland and the crisis is getting worse. And it's hard for me to look at those in a position who actually can do something saying, yeah, we're tired of giving, and feel a lot of empathy. But that's me. Final story comes from The Scanner. And it's titled, Community Process to Determine Art Center Head. So, according to the article, Portland's Albina Art Center, a symbol of Black Portland's creativity and self-determination, is going to be handed back to the city's Black community, partly as a way to make amends for decades of disruption, neglect, and divestment. At the request of the state of Oregon, the Oregon Community Foundation, OCF, which annually distributes more than $200 million statewide in grants and scholarships, is the current temporary administrator of the building. Currently, OCF is preparing for a community-led process that will eventually transfer permanent ownership of the one-story building to a Black-run 501c3 nonprofit willing to authentically honor the Black community's cultural ties to the facility. The selected organization will be chosen by community members and stakeholders participating in OCF's upcoming visioning conversations. Further along in the article, they write, Portland native Erica Warren, whose family has lived in Portland for three generations and is a partner at a consulting firm, Tri-Excellence LLC, will facilitate the community engagement process. A currently forming steering committee of up to 30 community members, in collaboration with Tri-Excellence and a key OCF staff, will help create structures that ensure the process is fair, transparent, and accountable to what the Black community wants to see happen to and within the building. The visioning process is expected to last at least 6 months. And last in the article, for over 15 months, a large portion of the building sat vacant until jazz musician and Portland State University professor Daryl Grant walked by the space and noticed the art of Portland native and arts curator Bobby Fother propped in the window. Together, the two well-respected Black creatives reactivated the empty, neglected space. Grant's experimental soul restoration project offered live jazz concerts, film screenings, visual art, and spoken word events. His project, though, ended at the end of January 2022. On February 1st, 2022, the Black-led program I Am More, which stands for Making Ourselves Resilient Every Day, LLC, founded by Renee Mitchell, an award-winning writer, teacher, and community visionary, moved in, signed a two-year lease, and renamed the large space the Soul Restoration Center with Grant's permission. I Am More's healing-centered and research-based curriculum is the foundation of the City of Portland's recent investment of $950,000 into the programming that specializes in leadership building and creative empowerment of Black youth. In the corner office space, another Black woman, Portland native Lisa Saunders, executive director of Faith Bridge LLC, and an ordained minister, offers Black women mental health support under contract with Multnomah County. So I want to highlight this article, one, because I'm a big believer in community space. And full disclosure, I actually did collaborate with Daryl Grant back in December to do the first part of my Black News Future panel series at the Albina Arts Center. But nonetheless, moving on, I want to say that community space, especially for Black people in Portland, is very valuable. A lot of the things I do are very much a product of community space, including this show right here in the Numbers studio that we're shooting. As I mentioned earlier, it provides an opportunity not just to engage in things like concerts and readings and film screenings and talks. It also provides a space for genuine safety and comfort for people to come together and meet those they wouldn't otherwise and have conversations that, frankly, are just hard to replicate over Zoom or, you know, in these spaces that are, you know, owned by the city or owned by institutions that have historically harmed us. So when we talk about the future of something like the Albina Arts Center, it's very important. And also when we talk about the process for determining what does it look like to hand this back to the Black community or hand this back to a Black nonprofit in a way that truly serves the community, it is interesting to look at this process and look at steering committee of 30 members to look at, you know, the different players involved and determine, again, how much transparency and accountability is happening here. Because, you know, this could be one of hopefully many spaces that don't just facilitate great activities, but also facilitate the growth, facilitate the development, especially of young people in our community and throughout the state. So again, we're going to stay tuned to the developments of the Albina Arts Center, but stay tuned, pay attention, and that is the news. The Bruce Poinsett Show will be back after this quick commercial break. The Bruce Poinsett Show is made possible by the support of members at patreon.com/brucepoinsett. Patreon is a service that allows you to directly support creators like myself through monthly or annual memberships. Become a member for as little as $3 a month and get access to exclusive bonus clips and live discussions. Check out this clip from the page.
Are you defending the prequels? Where does your defense end, Bruce?
So, you know what? Maybe this might surprise you, but yeah, the whole meal deal. I will defend the prequels, kind of. Again, I also had a disclaimer at the beginning that I would not put money on me if I were betting on this as a viewer, but will I defend the prequels? Yes. If you enjoy this content and believe in the community I'm trying to build, please support by becoming a member at patreon.com/BrucePoinsett. Welcome back to the Bruce Poinsett Show. You know, normally during the B block, we like to lighten things up a little bit, but look, Ado, we gotta talk about these grifters, man.
Yeah.
And I get it. Don't get me wrong. We live in scam culture. You know, especially during times of like a messed up economy, we gravitate towards people who are, you know, making something out of nothing, not always, you know, legally. I mean, one of the most prolific scammers of all time was most recently the president of the United States.
So, oh, yes.
You know, we know how far this goes. And as such, I shouldn't be surprised that people romanticize grifters, mm-hmm. even in social justice spaces.
Mm-hmm.
That said, you know, there are some effects.
As it goes.
So even if we don't mess with the grift, I feel like a lot of us are, you know, we're very live and let live people.
Mm-hmm.
We don't, you know, we might see something happening, but if you're not messing with us, you're not messing with our family, you're not messing mm-hmm. with our loved ones, we're good. Like, there's only so much you can do in this world.
If you don't mind me asking before we go any deeper, for those who may not know, what is a grifter, Bruce?
Grifter is basically another word for a scammer. In what we're going to be talking about today, specifically in social justice spaces, you know, it's someone who they use the rhetoric, you know, they latch on to movements,
mm-hmm.
usually incredibly narcissistic,
mm-hmm.
and basically they co-opt whether it be movements or anything else for themselves under the guise of, you know, the empowerment of the people, To be clear, usually they're not super transparent all the time. A lot of them, you know, they're mixed bags. They give you some good things. They do some good things, but they also do some disastrous things.
Yeah.
That make it kind of
harmful.
Yeah. Very obvious what they're actually doing. And then it becomes a matter of, you know, holding them accountable, which, again, as we talked about, it doesn't really happen.
Mm-hmm.
So, with that, when we talk again about this social justice space and we look at, you know, grifting, like we live in Oregon, it is something like 86% white.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Portland maybe slightly less, but still very, very, very white. So most of the people who are, you know, on the other end of the grift in this space, it's white people. And I'm not gonna lie, a lot of us, when we see it, it's kind of like a form of entertainment almost. Yep. It's like, you know, the same white people you see in a meeting who tell you, you know, they give you all the talking points. Like, I want to uplift black voices. I want to be a better ally. You see those people. Sometimes you roll your eyes at some of those people who are yes. clearly insincere. And then when you see them, you know, getting caught up by the grifters, it's just like, yeah. Not my problem.
Good times.
Yeah.
Good times for everyone, I'd say.
I get that. Yeah. I get that. But the problem with grift is, in order to sustain it, eventually you're going to get past just grifting easy, you know, people who are easy to root against,
uh-huh.
for lack of better terms.
Yes.
Eventually you're going to have to step your game up to sustain.
Oh.
And here in Portland, that is no different.
Mm-hmm.
And let's keep it real. I'm not going to go out of my way to name names, but if you've been in this space, especially like the activist social justice space for several years or so,
mm-hmm.
we all know who the grifters are out here. You know, there's certain signs. again, usually if you see this like cult of personality building and except all the followers around this person are all, you know, the I just want to be a better ally white people and you don't see cosigns from other black and brown people.
Grifter.
That's a, I'm not going to say necessarily a grifter, but it's a it's an important data point. You know what I mean? And again, like especially post 2020 George Floyd protests, for lack of better terms, the market opened up. Mm-hmm. Like there were a lot of people who wanted to be on the right side of history. You know, I'm sure they're good intention for the most part.
Right.
But also you have a lot of white people in Oregon who they don't actually like they're not in community with anyone else meaningfully. Mm-hmm. They, you know, they're very how can I put this nicely? They walk into these spaces very helplessly. That's nice, right?
Yeah. You know? You know.
When you ask them, you know, what's your reason for being here? I just
want to be better.
I just want to help and but please don't make me feel bad. Okay, please. I just want to. So anyone who can, you know, kind of feed that kind of, you know, feed into people's, you know, sense of justice.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of interpretations of that or instances of that where, you know, it's not the worst thing. It's not, it shouldn't be where it ends.
Right.
But, you know, you can get some good things from there. Unfortunately, when you're talking about grifters, that's not the point.
Mm-hmm.
You just want to catch the people right where they are, where it's like, do you listen to black people? Do you have any black people in your life? No? Well, don't worry. I am here.
I'm here to be that one.
And I will lead you to black liberation.
Oh.
Just listen to me, right? And it's, you know, the situation again, if it just stopped there, it'd be one thing. But the reality is with a lot of these grifters, they also feed into the state's anti-blackness in this weird way
mm-hmm.
where it's like their whole business model around black liberation is built on stepping on other black people, other black and brown people to get there, lifting themselves up in the eyes of their mostly white following. So you can get those donations. So you can get that, you know, that support. And it's, and weaponizing a lot of these white followers against them in right. the process, which gets a lot of us, other black and brown people in this space, it ends up pitting us against each other. And there's actual consequences.
Yes.
You know, and again, I want to stress, like, a lot of this comes from, you know, just the dynamics out here. And how could I put this again? I'll try and put this nicely, but in 2020, or post-2020, I should say, the white zombie market is fertile. Was that not putting it nicely? So what do I mean by that? Like, again, you have white people who want to be on the right side of history, mm-hmm. and they've heard some of the, you know, some of the phrases have kind of gone through. Like when people say, listen to black people, or like listen to black women, or getting more specific, listen to black trans women. Yes. They're like, yes, you're right. But what do they mean in practice?
Mm-hmm.
I've gone to one or two marches. I saw this person speak. So they're black. They must speak for black people.
Yes.
And I'm going to parrot everything they say.
This is my figure now.
Yes. And it's like, no, that's not, you know, when we say listen to black people, like people, not
person,
especially if someone is actually putting themselves out there as if they speak, like, you want to talk about warning signs. When someone poses themselves as speaking for the black community, there's your sign.
Sign number two.
Yeah. Right. And just stop for a minute, because there was like there were some good things from this, like amplifying this idea of listening to black people more.
Mm-hmm.
I do appreciate that.
Of course.
You know, normalizing talking points around, or even just talking about reparations. I like that.
Uh-huh.
Talking about, you know, normalizing the idea of, yeah, we should really pay black people. We should, you know, that's good.
Mm-hmm.
Even like this idea of centering those most marginalized. Like I'm part of this group, Imagine Black, where they use a black queer feminist lens, which is this idea of when we're dealing with these issues around social justice, again, centering the most marginalized, like, great. Mm-hmm. And it is good to proliferate that.
Yes.
But mm-hmm. again, when you're dealing with people who they're getting a bunch of knowledge all at once and, you know, they're just scrambling around trying to, again, be the good people they want to be.
Right.
What does it become? A grifter's paradise. Can the people following this not see that this is also happening? Like, if you're saying you got to listen to black people, but not that one. Yeah. Not that one. Nope. Not
only this one.
Only me. Right. Like, if you're watching that, you can't put two and two together and be like, this seems off.
Yeah.
Isn't it off that all these other black people who occupy this space and do this work will not, you know, they're not co-signing this. Like, we all know each other. Isn't that weird? Isn't it? No one asks. In some cases, you have these, how do you put this? Especially when, like, tension, because, like, this really comes to light, you know, black people are not a monolith. So when we have tensions with each other in this space, when we have disagreements, whether it's over personal stuff or just over tactics, mm-hmm. and those play out publicly, what happens? Especially when you've built up a white following. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, it becomes entertainment for people.
It does.
You know, we talk about becoming entertainment watching the grift happen, but then it flips on us and we become the entertainment.
Once again.
Except it's amplified because it's thousands of white people on Twitter or IG or Facebook who are jumping in and taking sides.
Right.
And you have, like, it was kind of dispiriting in a lot of ways, especially like 2020, 2021, when some of these arguments would break out and you'd see people accusing other people of being COINTELPRO. Just quick history lesson for people. COINTELPRO was a counterintelligence program used by the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover during, you know, first on as an anti-communist movement, and then it really blew up with the civil rights movement, mm-hmm. the Black Power movement. And the idea was to infiltrate and basically destroy these civil rights movements. And it included spying, and include having, you know, people go in and sow dissent, even include having people sow, you know, not sow, but actually use violence and assassination. Mm. Like, it did a number on a lot of people. They spied on Martin Luther King Jr. They spied on Malcolm X. Mm-hmm. They, you know, so, you know, when people just kind of, to bring it back to now, watching people just kind of casually throw that around and be like, you're COINTELPRO because I disagree with you. And I was just like,
oh,
who taught you this?
This is so negative.
But then also, I guess it makes sense. Like, even if you're not, you know, part of some operation, mm-hmm. if the main function or if the end function is still, okay, you're sowing tension within the community, you're, you know, basically throwing a lot of these plans of this organizing off kilter,
right?
Whether on purpose or not, is it not the same effect? You know, but it continues. And like, again, because we have this whole live and let live thing, and because we know the history of COINTELPRO, we know the history of just in general, you know, especially in a place like Oregon, black people being pitted against each other. Mm-hmm. A lot of us go out of our way, even in these instances where it's like, oh, this is clearly wrong, not to like down these people, like at least make a public display of downing these people.
Right.
Because we know that'll be exploited. And we know how, you know, other systems work. Like, if, you know, someone becomes a pariah, especially if you're a black person who becomes a pariah, there's a lot less support for you mm-hmm. than, you know, a white pariah out here.
Yes.
So people are very careful. People are very, very kind and complimentary on this stuff, even when they don't have to be, even when they're directly negatively affected. Mm-hmm. Trust me, I've been one of them. Mm. But, and I understand why, but it persists. And you see people, you see these same people. It doesn't matter how many times publicly. Like, it's one thing if this is behind the scenes, but some of these people out here, they've been on prolific runs in public of the grift of, you know, ooh, this thing spectacularly burns down and everyone sees it. This other thing spectacularly burns down and everyone sees it. This other thing and everyone sees it. But then, you know, the white zombies are still out there like,
this is my person.
Yeah. And it's just, it's wild. And it's like, what do you do about that? Sometimes I'm at a loss. And, you know, I do want to use one specific example because people are always going to be like, well, what do you mean? What do you mean?
Let's hear it.
So during the 2020 elections for a city commissioner, you had black man Mingus Maps running against white woman Chloe Udaly. Now, Mingus Maps was well known to be endorsed by the police union before he ran, as he was running. Udaly, on the other hand, was a known tenants' rights advocate. Yet somehow, some very influential voices in sort of the activist community took to Mingus Maps and basically lifted him up as like not just the black candidate, obviously he's the black candidate in this issue, but like the candidate for black people and made it like a black empowerment, you know, moment, an opportunity by electing him. And, you know, people called it out at the time of being like, no, he's endorsed by the police union. Some of you are literally doing marches talking about abolish the police. How can you
support him?
Yeah. How can you be endorsing this person? And not just over some random person, over a tenants' rights advocate.
Yes.
A proven tenants' rights advocate during a pandemic.
Yeah.
You know, it was wild. It was wild. It seemed pretty transparent. It seemed ridiculous at the time, but it worked. He won. And since he's won, what has he done? Everything you'd expect. Anytime there's been a comment about the police, it's a bad one. And there's an opportunity to, you know, raise the police budget. They did it. And to be fair, it's not just him. The city council voted unanimously. And even people like the police union hates Joanne Hardesty, but she voted for it. So it's not all Mingus. But again, when there's this opportunity in this election and people who knew better lifted this person endorsed by the police union up, while also marching for, you know, not just police lives. Accountability, not just police reform, but in some cases, abolition.
Yes.
Those two don't mix. And we all saw it with our own eyes.
Yes, we did.
And it's like, at least, you know, mistakes happen. We're all young out here. Well, not all of us.
We're learning, though.
Yeah,
we're
learning. Some of these people who did this. But, you know, we make mistakes out here, right? And that's fine. But if people don't say anything, don't take any account, they just get real quiet about it and their followers act as if it never happened, I don't know what's going to happen in the next elections. What's going to happen when this opportunity comes up again? Because it's not like it's the first time you've had, you know, a black candidate who's basically, you know, been very open about being, you know, part of that system or being supportive of that system. It's not the first time that's happened. It's not the first time you've had a black candidate who's been lifted up as like by some people as like this image of social justice when he wasn't. Like it happens all the time. But if we don't learn from it, if we talk about we're in this time of awakening, at some point we gotta like awaken. Yeah. But it continues, and I wish I had an answer, but honestly, a lot of times I think to myself, you know what? It's all, you can't beat them, join them. Right.
Right.
Like, well, who am I? Why am I trying to, you know, what is the point of trying to do the right thing out here? Like, think about how much money one could make if you just, you know, embraced taking full advantage of this white zombie market.
Correct.
And clearly, as aforementioned, you know, grifters have proven, it's very easy to do it without, you know, in plain sight.
Yes.
With virtually no consequences. and no one across the board cares.
No one's complaining.
So why shouldn't I? You know, Ada, what if I were a grifter for a day? So it's the third of the month, everyone, which means it's time for reparations to me, your personal revolutionary black friend. Remember when you marched with me 2 years ago? Didn't you love that feeling, the adrenaline, those bad white people at brunch giving you those mean stares and glares as you bravely stood up for black lives and got your steps in? Remember that? Well, where have you been since? Have you uplifted any black voices today? Have you? Have you given to my Cash App yet today? Have you? Have you paid reparations to me? Well, don't let these politicians fool you. Don't let these House Negro nonprofits, and yes, I said House Negro. If I wasn't real, would I call them House Negroes for you white people? Would I? No. Stop letting them take your money without giving you real justice. These people, they're ops. You can tell. You want to know how you can tell? How many of them mess with me? None of them?
They're ops.
Yeah. They're scared of me because I speak the truth. Because I want real black liberation, not reform, not change. I want liberation. I want freedom for my people. I want reparations today in my Cash App. All I need is your help and your donations. Because remember, I am your personal revolutionary black friend. Power to the people. Cash App in the description. The Bruce Poinsett Show will be back after this quick ad break. BrucePoinsett.com is your one-stop shop for everything Bruce Poinsett. You have my services such as freelance writing and editing, creative nonfiction courses, as well as customized writing classes, event facilitation, and digital content creation. Again, go to BrucePoinsett.com for a quote and make sure to sign up for our newsletter so you don't miss any news or updates. Welcome back to the Church of Can't Stop, Won't Stop. I'm your host, Bruce Poinsett, and this is the show where we take the book Can't Stop, Won't Stop, A History of the Hip Hop Generation by Jeff Chang, and we link it to just the history of Portland hip hop, because a lot of these stories are universal. And today I have not just a special guest, but possibly the guest with me, the author himself, Mr. Jeff Chang. Jeff, how are you doing this morning?
Oh man, I'm good. I'm good, Bruce, and I'm honored to be here. Thank you so much for doing this podcast and, you know, just sort of getting these stories out into the world.
Yeah. It's an honor to have you on here. And we're just going to jump right into it because, you know, there's one of the themes I've kind of talked about in here is just like the connection to Portland, to other areas and their stories. And, you know, you being in the Bay Area, there's a special Portland Bay Area connection. But in your case, in particular, one of the most influential, impactful groups, like you were the person who signed them. The Lifesavers, who were recently inducted into the Oregon Music Hall of Fame. So can you just kind of talk about that story as far as, just talk about the importance and the significance and like when you got the news that they were being inducted, like how did that, just what were your thoughts?
I can't take any credit for signing them. I was part of the Soul Size crew, which became Quantum Projects. And what I think happened over the years is, you know, a lot of the different scenes on the West Coast were really in touch with each other. And the guys would go, when I say the guys, I mean, you know, the crew, particularly folks like, you know, Chief XL, Gifted Gab, may he rest in peace, DJ Shadow, Lyrics Born, you know, Latita True Speaker would go to Portland and link up with Jumbo and Versatile and they just bonded real deep, like minds and stuff. And so that it was just sort of an expansion of, you know, of the crew, beyond like where we had started in the bay. But the links like go deep because we were all kind of, I would say, kind of like rebels, you know, like folks who were trying to forge kind of a new sound and a new kind of way of looking at things, of the world, you know, through music. And in that regard, like, you know, thinking about what Jumbo and Versatile, you know, in particular were doing, you know, with all of their work in the community, you know, with youth, and, you know, and thinking about sort of what they're also trying to do aesthetically, it was all kind of a piece together, you know. And to me, like, thinking about them being recognized for all of their incredible music and their work, you know, in just in the arts, generally, along with like knowing what their standing is, in the community, what it means to Portland, particularly to communities of color, and to and how that ripples, you know, through all of our different sort of scenes and that kind of thing. It was just like beautiful. It was like poetic justice. It was like really, really wonderful to and heartwarming to kind of see them get the love for doing all the things that, you know, they never, I don't think they ever started doing that stuff thinking, oh yeah, I'm gonna do this and, you know, become super famous and worldwide known and that kind of thing for, you know, all of these different types of stuff. Like, I think that they were like, we do this because we do it for the love. And of course, you know, as time goes on, everybody begins to see their excellence. But to have it now kind of locked in, right, for all time, for somebody to be able to come here, like a young person coming in here a generation from now going, man, what kind of, you know, what kind of stuff, you know, was going on back then, and being able to be like brought into what it is that they leave as their legacy, it's just really powerful, man. It's just, it's really, really moving to me. It's really poignant.
I was curious, like, how do you feel about how the book has resonated, especially in places, be it like Portland or, you know, other areas that don't have that huge, like, national hip hop reputation?
I mean, the thing about, well, I think the gift of like Black freedom culture has been the way that it's been able to pull, it's been able to reveal to everyone, I think, especially folks like me who are not Black, the truth, right, of America. The truth of our history, the truth of our trajectory, like the truth of what we're capable of, both in terms of the violence and the debasement of humans, right? But also in terms of like the collectivity and the creativity, like of humans as well. And so that's been a gift, I think, of Black freedom culture all the way through. And I think, you know, that's the part that, you know, in pulling the book together, both times, it's just been really invigorating. And I think, it's just been really powerful, you know, to be able to see the ways in which, you know, Afro-diasporic peoples and cultures have paved the way. And you know, and so I'm starting off really broad trying to answer your very specific question here, because I think it's really important for people to kind of understand that that's why these stories resonate all around the world, right? Not just in New York City or Los Angeles or the metropolises, you know, where the stories that some of the book comes from, like, are about, like, they resonate everywhere. There are people of color, there are people who are oppressed, there are people who are struggling, there are people who are also surviving, who are making beautiful things, making beautiful communities, out of, you know, out of nothing, making a way out of no way, right, as Bruce Lee would say. And so, you know, for me, like, being able to go, like, this book is taking me around the world, you know, and being able to go to, like, all of these cities on pretty much, like, almost every continent, and be able to meet directly with others who are going through similar type of stuff and who have been inspired by hip hop has just been, it's just been such a gift, right? And so, you know, that's I think maybe the big picture of it, you know. The question specifically about Portland, it for me is that, you know, it's like Portland, like, needs to get its love, you know, from the rest of the hip hop world in so many ways. Portland's a kind of place where it's been recognized for, you know, its graphic design, its art, you know, its food, all of these beautiful things that it's been able to contribute and, sort of like be recognized for, in American and global culture. But, you know, Portland hip hop, I mean, from the first time that I went into Portland, seeing the graffiti everywhere, being invited into the neighborhoods by Verse, to meet with the kids and seeing the incredible, powerful creativity, amidst, like, intense gentrification, right, and sort of resegregation, amidst, of course, all of the struggles with, like, the legacies and the continuing present of white supremacy, and white supremacist groups. Like, Portland has had a lot to say, and it's all there in the music, it's all there in the hip hop culture. So I think that, you know, for me, I always look to Portland as a beacon, as a way for, I look to work like Walid and Marisha's work, that's been able to point the way forward for us in terms of being able to think about the past and the future and the present, right? And to be able to think about the prison industrial complex and its ties to histories of white supremacy and slavery. Like, Walid has been incredibly influential on my own work as well. And all of that is, you know, is really deeply a part of what the character of Portland hip hop is about. So I think that story needs to be told. And in that way, I'm really glad that you're doing this, and, you know, that all of our friends out there are continuing to carry the, you know, carry that flag.
So lastly, you know, obviously I do my own documentation thing, but also work with a bunch of students. And I was curious, like, what advice would you have in terms of people trying to document their, again, in places like Portland or other places that, you know, stories, who have stories that need to get told? What advice would you have for people trying to document their local hip hop scenes?
Oh, man, I love this question. I really love this question. When the book first kind of came out, you know, I felt like I was being real didactic when I did this, but I tried to, every time I presented the book, wherever I went, you know, tell folks, look, you know, the pioneers of the scene in your town, like you, are not going to live forever. And the one thing that struck me over and over again when I was going out to do the research for Can't Stop, Won't Stop the first time, and this is something that I learned from Davey, you know, as sort of that premier hip-hop historian, is there are so many stories that are not going to ever get captured in the quote-unquote official record, right, that aren't necessarily going to be in the newspaper or whatever, like, social media feed that you're checking out, right? But these are the stories that make the present moment what it is, right? And so it's a process of being able to do what you do, Bruce, which is to document, to capture those stories, because all these stories carry the seeds of, you know, a better future for us, or a different kind of future, another world that we can create together. And so it's really, really, really crucial. And we tried to do that in this book, for every scene, not just the scenes that have artists who have topped the charts, such as New York or Los Angeles, you know, or I don't know, Miami or Atlanta or the Bay Area even. It's really, really crucial that people go in and get those stories, because they hold the key, right? They hold the key. These are things that the OGs are passing down to us, who are passing it, need to pass it down to young folks, so they can understand the continuity. Like, everything about the world that we live in is about cutting you off from your past. And it's about making things seem really mystical or out of reach, you know. But there are people who in every generation rise up, who bring people together, who make possible changes. And the reasons that they do that are embedded in these stories. The ways that they did that are embedded in these stories. And the results of it are embedded in these stories. And that's why, you know, they don't want you to know those stories. That's why there's this constant forward march away from the past, to make it seem as if you don't have, like, any of those types of things to draw on. You have only the things that are given to you, you know, via the social media aspects, via your quote-unquote official schooling, and all that kind of stuff. We've been able, I think, in our generation to make inroads so that Twitter now can be used, right, as an organizing tool, so that teachers like Jesse and documentarians like you can get into, like, these institutions to be able to tell these stories, that I can get this book published and have it out all around the world and stuff. But it's never enough. And there's always missing pieces. And I just, I always think, the older I get, the more I always think, gosh, if I had known what I knew when I wrote the book, when I was in my 20s, maybe things would have been a lot different, you know? And so that's why we do the work that we do, I think. And I just think, you know, they're there, the OGs are there, like, go and sit down with them, go and talk to them, learn from them, get them to mentor you if they're feeling up to it, you know? And then, like, take that stuff and pass it on, because one day you're going to be that OG as well, that you're hoping that somebody will knock on your door, to ask about stuff, because there's going to be a lot of stuff that, you know, then that you need to pass on before you pass on. So yeah,
that's a word. Jeff, thank you again for, you know, taking the time, reflecting on the book, reflecting on Lifesavers, you know, just the connection to Portland. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we hop off?
Oh man, just thank you for this, man. Thank you for all that you do. And yeah, you know, we don't give each other enough love. You know, this work can be really hard sometimes. You know, you kind of write alone, you know, in your little office and stuff. You never know how it's getting out into the world. So, this connection really like makes me happy. And just, you know, I just want to give the love that I'm feeling a little bit back, you know, to you and to everybody else who's like making it happen. Yeah, we've got to definitely, especially in these times, man, we've got to remind each other like how important and how appreciative we are of each other's work. So thank you, man. Really appreciate you.
Sure. Thank you. And yeah, thanks again for taking the time, and enjoy the rest of your day.
This has been the Bruce Poinsett Show. Make sure to catch us every second and fourth Wednesday at 7 p.m. on the Numbers FM, as well as on youtube.com/Bruce Poinsett. And for exclusive clips, go to patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett and become a member. In the meantime, hey, black people, trust me, it won't hurt. See you next week.